Hello, I'm Anthony DP Mann. This is number 0429, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0429. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Dr. John Shufeld, who is both a doctor and a lawyer. He shares his insight on how hospitals and communities deal with the aftermath of mass shootings.
In some extent, we maintain a high level of readiness for these mass casualties, and the trauma systems are generally in large towns like Phoenix and Las Vegas, very well coordinated centrally. I don't think any city would have been completely prepared for the number of victims that happened with the Mandalay Bay incident, but from everything I've heard about Las Vegas, they did a phenomenally admirable job.
Dr. Michael H. Stone is the author of The Anatomy of Evil.
There's a difference between evil actions and people who are evil from the minute they wake up in the morning till the minute they go to sleep. In other words, there's very few people who are, you might say, perpetually evil or in meantime doing evil acts with some regularity. There are such people. There's a number that come to mind, you know, who've done rapes and murders with great regularity.
Andy Nullman talks about his new game app, Play the Future. It's trivia with a future twist that you can't readily find the answer to.
We call it future trivia because of Siri, Alexa, and Google, trivia is dead. Any trivia question you ask can be answered within a second or a microsecond just by saying, Siri, how many X's are in Y? If the answer is no, it can be looked up. But if you're talking about making predictions about tomorrow, no matter what, it cannot be looked up because it hasn't happened yet.
And we have lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later. The person who told you this was show number 0429 was Anthony D.P. Mann, filmmaker and actor who produces some amazing work with his company Bleak December Incorporated. You got to check out some of his stuff. I put a link in from the Stuff File page to his webpage so you can sample some of his talents, and you've got to listen to some of the audio shows he puts together. They are absolutely breathtaking. Great fun, great stories, some of them very macabre. A lot of fun indeed. And speaking of Anthony, thanks to him for setting up a book signing for me in Kingston, Ontario that I had over the weekend. It was at Novel Idea Bookstore, and it was great fun to meet folks and sign copies of my book, Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. And it was also great to see Anthony and his lovely bride, Lisa. Thanks, Anthony, for doing the guest slate and also for your hospitality when I was in Kingston. Thanks for mentioning the guest slate here on this program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join Patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Okay, if you rob a roadside wiener stand at gunpoint, what is the most poetic form of justice you can think of? Yeah. A 19-year-old man who allegedly held up a Southside Chicago hot dog stand shot himself in the weenie while running away. Terrion Pouncey was arrested at the Oak Lawn Hospital not long after he was found slumped on the steps of a home across the street from a West Pullman restaurant that Chicago police say he robbed at gunpoint at around 6 a.m. on Halloween. Pouncey was unable to run further because of the pain of the self-inflicted gunshot wound that he suffered when he tried to adjust the .38 caliber pistol he had in his waistband as he ran off. Pouncey had pulled out the gun and demanded cash from two employees, pressing the gun to the head of a 39-year-old worker. Still pointing the gun at the workers, Pouncey stooped over to collect the cash, shifting the gun in his waistband as he ran out. He apparently pulled the trigger, firing a bullet that struck him in the penis. Surveillance cameras captured video and audio of the robbery and showed Pouncey struggling to make it across the street, stop on a bench, and make his way to the steps of a nearby house before collapsing. Okay, it's a serious injury, but I'm sure it will be difficult for everyone at his arraignment and trial not to laugh. The judge will stifle his or her laughter. The attorneys will stifle their laughter. The bailiff will. All court reporters will. And perhaps even the jury will. Maybe Pouncey should just plead guilty to avoid embarrassment. Then again, all of his cellmates will be laughing too. And his least offensive jailhouse nickname will be Shorty. Yeah. Nellie's Taqueria in Hicksville, New York, suffered a break-in on October 3rd, but the burglar redefined the term clean getaway. Surveillance video shows a man donning food service gloves and starting a pot of water to boil before hammering open the cash register. He secured $100 in his pockets, leaving a dollar in the tip jar, then started cooking up a storm, said owner Will Cologne. Cameras recorded as the thief cooked beans, sautéed shrimp and chicken, and helped himself to a cold soda before enjoying his meal standing up. The way he handled that pan, man, that dude had some skills, Cologne said. Afterward, he carefully stored the leftovers in the refrigerator, cleaned his pans, and wiped down all the surfaces he had used. Then he took off through the back window the same way he came in. Gee, I don't know if Will Cologne should have him arrested or if he should hire him. But if he does get captured, he's a lock to run the prison kitchen. I mean, seriously. And finally in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. When 20-year-old Shelby McDowell learned that her alleged boyfriend, Darby Johns, would be attending a wedding without her, she followed her instincts, grabbed a wig, and trailed him to a wedding at a resort in Palm Coast, Florida. Now, when she allegedly spotted Johns dancing and kissing another woman on the dance floor, she threw a drink on and then punched this other woman before fleeing to a bathroom. But wait, there's more. According to McDowell, members of the bridesmaid's party then allegedly followed her into the bathroom, pulled her out by her feet, and proceeded to punch her. However, resort officials tell a different story, that when the manager arrived to stop the fight, McDowell was the only one doing any punching. In a statement, McDowell claimed that she, quote, never intended for it to have gotten so out of control, unquote, and she shared, I am aware that going to a wedding uninvited is wrong. I am aware that pouring a drink on someone is also wrong. She maintains that she was not the inciter of violence, adding, after the drink incident, if the girls had not attacked me, there would never have been such a chaotic scene. But McDowell did have one sincere apology. I am very apologetic towards the bride and groom since this happened at their wedding. Meanwhile, Johns claims both that he is not McDowell's boyfriend and that he had merely been walking to the dance floor with this other woman when they were attacked. You know, someone is a little delusional here. Someone may be a potential bunny boiler. I'm just saying. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? When an overwhelming tragedy strikes, how prepared are the resources in the community involved? For instance, how does a hospital respond to the mass casualties of victims in scenarios like the recent shootings in Las Vegas at the Mandalay Bay? And how does a city deal with the aftermath? Dr. John Shufeld is here to talk about that issue, and he's well-versed on many sides of it. He is both an emergency room physician and an attorney, and he joins us now on the line from Arizona. Hi, John.
Thank you so much for having me on your show. How are you doing?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for doing this. First of all, I got to say right off the bat, a doctor and a lawyer. Your parents must have been over the moon.
Well, either that or it's, you know, I was overcompensating for something.
Okay. So let's talk about the first part of what I've just mentioned, and that is taking care of a situation when it's overwhelming, be it a shooting like this or, say, an earthquake or any kind of disaster that may befall, be it man-made or not. How do hospitals, I know they prepare for this, but are they ever really ready for it?
Well, in some extent, we maintain a high level of readiness for these mass casualties, and the trauma systems are generally in large towns like Phoenix and Las Vegas, very well coordinated centrally. I don't think any city would have been completely prepared for the number of victims that happened with the Mandalay Bay incident. But from everything I've heard about Las Vegas, they did a phenomenally admirable job.
We saw a similar situation to this, unfortunately, previous to this in Florida. Can you compare the two as far as how they were handled?
Well, it sounds like in Florida as well. I mean, the way the trauma system is set up, the scene is secured, and is best as you can. Or if it's not secured, victims are moved to a secure area where they're triaged, and they're triaged meaning people who are unfortunately going to die more likely than not, no matter what you do. Those people are made as comfortable as possible. People who, with rapid intervention, could be saved, and those people are taken to the trauma centers and the local emergency departments as fast as possible. And then the people where a small amount of time or a large amount of time, you know, they call them the walk-in wounded, will be okay if there's a delay. And they, too, are taken to area hospitals, maybe not the trauma centers, which may be overwhelmed, but more outlying facilities with not the rapidity with the true traumas are taken. So it's really generally well coordinated once the scene becomes secure.
Well, you're a doctor, so let me ask you this question from the triage point of view. And you just mentioned that there are some people when they come in to the triage experience, that some of them aren't going to make it no matter what you do, and that basically the decision is taken out of your hands to save those that you can save. What about those who come in who are, shall we say, on the borderline? You know you can save them, but there is somebody else that is in a more dire situation. Is that a difficult position to put doctors and nurses in?
Well, it's incredibly difficult, and sometimes those decisions are made at the scene. In other words, somebody's rapidly evaluated by a physician, nurse, or paramedic, and you know, generally those cases, a paramedic, and they make the call or call up and ask for collaboration and say, here are the two patients. I know you have room for one, or we can only take one because we have one methodology to get them to the hospital. What are your thoughts? And then, unfortunately, the decision's made one way or another. And, you know, someone's alive with a bad head wound. Chances are they ultimately will not have a meaningful recovery. Those people, although they're still alive, may go second to somebody who has an abdominal wound, who is exsanguinating, i.e. losing a lot of blood, that you could treat emergently and survive neurologically intact.
It's horrific for any community to go through something like this, but having said that, once it's said and done, does the community, and by extension other communities that are witnessing what has taken place, do you all learn things from what happened? In other words, is there anything right now you can say that was learned from a medical perspective as to what happened at the Mandalay Bay shooting?
We're about 6 hours away by car, but I definitely know providers there. And certainly, you know, we call it a post-mortem, which is kind of an odd term, but we go back and talk, and I know the systems have already talked through this, what we've done better, what worked well, what do we need to improve upon. So there's always something to learn, I don't know if that's been disseminated yet from the Las Vegas incident, but there will soon be literature coming out about what worked well, what we thought may have worked well that didn't, and maybe what we didn't think would work well that worked really well. So that data will be coming out relatively soon. But from everything we knew as medical professionals, the folks in Las Vegas did a phenomenal job.
Well, let's take off your medical hat for a second and put on your legal one, and that is the aftermath and how a city deals with such a thing. I'm somehow concerned about the idea that we're always looking for answers, and I agree that answers should be sought, but I don't know if we should always be looking for blame, and I seem to see that happening more often these days. Do you agree?
I do agree. I mean, yeah, I do agree. And I don't think it's on a path that will ultimately be a fruitful path. In other words, will ultimately accomplish what people are hoping to gain from it. I think we are in a little bit of a blame society right now, and I don't think much good comes from that. If you can learn while being empathetic, while holding people accountable, I think that's the path that's, I think, the most constructive.
In your professional capacity, and this is both medical and legal, how should one move forward? How should a society, a city, a medical profession move forward from something like this?
Well, I think the people involved should all go through some sort of debriefing, some post-traumatic stress debriefing, because, you know, just from, you know, just from emergency medicine work, and I did some work with the police force, you know, no matter how quote-unquote strong you are mentally or physically, there just leaves some scars. So talking about it, going through counseling, I think is crucial. Trying to learn from it on the medical side, things to improve upon, I think that's crucial too. And then finally, as a society, what we've done to prevent it, I think that's a harder question, you know, whether it's gun control, whether it's more better security. You know, we live in a free society, and with that free society comes problems like this, unfortunately. And so we have to constantly weigh our legal rights, our civil rights versus safety. And, you know, that's for the lawmakers to decide. But I think that's what people have to wrestle with.
I think on the positive side, and I think we've just seen this play out again, unfortunately, recently in New York, I think on the positive side, the one thing we can always depend upon is the resiliency of mankind in general to want to overcome these things and get on with life. Would you agree?
Completely. You know, you look at the parades on Halloween and the parties on Halloween in New York and say, wow, but, you know, I think the mayor de Blasio said, well, hey, we're New Yorkers, you know, and we're A, a little bit used to this, unfortunately, and B, we're resilient as hell. And I think that resiliency, you know, has defined the North American cultures and other countries as well. So you're right. So thank God for that.
On a separate note, because we're just about done here, but I just want to mention you also, in addition to being a doctor and a lawyer, you have a consultant business, right?
I do. So I write some books on leadership, and I do a little bit of consulting, but mostly I tell people I haven't worked a day in my life.
Well, it seems like you keep very, very busy. I thank you for taking a little bit of the time of your day to chat with us on the program. Thanks for being with us.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Dr. John Shufeld. As I mentioned, in addition to being a doctor and a lawyer, he is also a consultant. You can find out more information about him by going to his website, shufeldconsulting.com. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check on the show number for this program, which is show number 0429, and you'll find the link to John's site. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like, but the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Batteries not included, some assembly required.
And still to come on the program, we'll look into the anatomy of evil, plus Andy Nullman talks about his new game app, Play the Future. We also have an Idiot of the Day coming your way a little later on, and a lot more Stuff File news here on a program that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make the show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, according to Winter Haven, Florida police, 33-year-old Stephanie Stinson told her 15-year-old daughter she wanted to buy some marijuana. Her daughter texted a 15-year-old boy she knew who could provide the drugs. When they met for the deal, Stinson allegedly gave the teen $20 for a bag of pot and apparently expected some change back. The teen didn't offer any, and when he tried to get back into his car, police say Stinson rammed her car into his and sent the boy flying over the car and into the road. Stinson's daughter called 911 as they drove away. How nice of her. The boy was airlifted to a hospital with multiple injuries. Stinson and her daughter went to the police department the next morning, and the mother was charged with leaving the scene of a crash involving injury and contributing to the delinquency of a minor. Yeah. How come she wasn't charged with, you know, trying to mow the kid down, you know, using a deadly weapon, basically? Anyway, I guess Stephanie is unaware of inflation. The price of drugs has gone up since she was 15, and also has the cost of running over a 15-year-old. That's gone up, too. She'll find that out the hard way. 60-year-old Robert James Kufler of White Bear, Minnesota, sent Christmas cards to relatives reporting his brother and mother were in bad health and didn't want visitors or phone calls. A concerned neighbor noticed that she hadn't seen the two for a while and called police to do a welfare check. Officers found two dead bodies. Kufler told them his twin brother had been dead for about 16 months and his mother had been dead for about 13 months. Police said the man's body was mummified and the woman's decayed and skeletal. Their deaths were ruled natural, but Kufler was charged with interference with a dead body or scene of death. Okay, is it really interference if you don't do anything? That seems to be the antithesis of interference, don't you think? Anyway, Kufler went on to declare, "I am not some nutball," adding he doesn't need any counseling. He didn't report the two deaths because I was traumatized, and asked a reporter, "What would you do?" I'm going out on a limb here, but I think the easy answer to that would be report the deaths. Yeah, anyway. Quick-thinking paramedics in Dorset, England saved the life of a man whose fishing outing went south when a Dover sole jumped down his throat and blocked his windpipe. 28-year-old Sam Quilliam had just caught a 5.5-inch long fish and went to give it a kiss when it wiggled free and lodged in his throat. "I ran around the pier like a headless chicken and then passed out," Quilliam told The Guardian. When first responders arrived, Quilliam was not breathing, his friends were performing CPR, and paramedic Matt Harrison said it was clear that we needed to get the fish out or this patient was not going to survive. "I was able to eventually dislodge the tip of the tail, and very carefully, so as not to break the tail off, I tried to remove it, although the fish's barbs and gills were getting stuck on the way back up. Finally, the fish came out in one piece," Harrison said. Quilliam said his brush with death won't put him off fishing. "Once I'm back at work and fit, I will probably be back at it again," he said. Okay, perhaps he should just curtail the idea of trying to kiss his catch. I'm just saying. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. In Italy, 40-year-old fitness instructor Laura Messi made news when she married herself in late September. "I told my relatives and friends that if I had not found my soulmate, I would marry myself by my 40th birthday." She spent more than 10,000 euros, that's about $11,700 US, for the occasion, which included a white wedding dress, a three-tiered cake, bridesmaids, and 70 guests. Messi is part of a self-marrying movement dubbed sologamy, or sologamy, depending how you pronounce it, that has followers all over the world. Her marriage holds no legal significance. "If tomorrow I find a man to build a future with, I will be happy, but my happiness will not depend on him," Messi declared. Okay. But if she finds that man, will she have to divorce herself first? And by the way, if she finds that man and she just merely dates him, is she having an affair behind her own back? This is very confusing. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, shall we? Renowned psychiatrist Michael H. Stone explores the concept and reality of evil from a new perspective. He is the author of The Anatomy of Evil, which is an in-depth discussion of the personality traits and behaviors that constitute evil across a wide spectrum. It's a scientific approach to a topic that for centuries has been inadequately explained by religious doctrines. Dr. Stone joins us on the line right now from New York. Hi, Michael.
Hello.
Thank you very much for being on the program with us, sir.
My pleasure.
What was the impetus for putting this book together in the first place?
Well, I began to see more and more aberrations of personality by virtue of being called upon to be an expert witness in certain law cases. In other words, my original area of expertise was in borderline personality disorder. But then after I got to be known for that condition, sometimes I would get called by a lawyer or a law company and saying, we have this couple in a very ugly custody case where the husband is saying that my wife is borderline and therefore she can't be a good mother, so I'm going to actually get the kids. And oftentimes the mother would be a perfectly decent mother, and the husband and wife were getting along, but she was not really a bad person as far as her maternal care. So I would help defend oftentimes, you know, the mother in those situations. But then I would get called upon to look at even more extreme cases, including sometimes cases involving murder. So I then moved from an expertise in borderline personality to get involved with the extremes of personality aberration, including antisocial people and finally psychopaths. And I would get called upon to examine and talk, you know, to murderers in prisons and things of that sort. So that got me interested in these extremes. And some of the people did things which were horrifying that make you just wince or your jaws drop. And where the person who is a witness or hears about a particular kind of heinous crime says, oh my God, that was evil. So I began then to write about different kinds of cases that involve horrifying circumstances that elicited the word evil from journalists, from ordinary people hearing about something, from even from judges and prosecutors. And so I began to write articles about that, and they got picked up by the New York Times. Ben Carey, the journalist in the New York Times, then featured me in a Tuesday morning a newspaper article about evil. And then Discovery Channel got interested in it and asked me if I would be willing to be a host going around the country interviewing people in prisons who committed acts which many people, including myself, would call evil. So I agreed to, I was very happy to do that. And I have a very large collection of at this point, about 800 full-length biographies, true crime biographies of serial killers, mass murderers, spousal murderers, and all different varieties of serious crime. And so I gave them suggestions as to which people would be interesting to interview, if they were willing to be interviewed. And they had the right to say no, but if they agreed to be interviewed and the warden said it was okay, then the Discovery Channel photography team and I would go around the country, different states and different prisons, and interview some of these individuals. And it was that that then got me started writing the book, which I call The Anatomy of Evil.
Well, it's interesting that you have the word evil in there and the way you've just described it, because it's been my experience of late, especially in this day and age when you watch 24-hour news services that are available out there, that it seems to be people have a hard time equating someone as being just simply evil. I'll give you the most recent example, and that is the shooting that took place in Las Vegas just recently.
Yeah.
Whenever you hear about what somebody has done that is so heinous, they always want to go to the extreme where that person must be in some way, shape, or form mentally ill. It is no longer just simply viable for someone to say, well, that person was evil. How do you feel about that?
Well, first of all, there's a difference that I make between evil actions and people who are evil from the minute they wake up in the morning till the minute they go to sleep. In other words, there's very few people who are, you might say, perpetually evil, or and in meantime doing evil acts with some regularity. There are such people, Leonard Fraser in Australia. There's a number that come to mind, you know, who've done rapes and murders with great regularity. Then there are evil acts, and the person is committing an evil act, such as Stephen Paddock in Las Vegas. The interesting thing about him is that he's not somebody who was known for doing evil acts one month after the other, one year after the other, although his father was one of the 10 most wanted in the FBI, you know, for armed robbery. And then one of his three brothers has been a violent criminal. So he has a psychopathic father and a psychopathic brother. And he himself is a kind of a loner, Paddock was, and may have inherited some genetic predisposition to very low empathy, very low ability for compassion, so that he was capable under certain circumstances of doing an act which would then elicit this word evil. However, about him, we know next to nothing as to what prompted that mass murder in Las Vegas.
Okay, so you say he may have inherited something. Are you saying that his disposition was nature and not nurture, or a combination of both?
In his case, it appears to be more nature than nurture. Well, we don't know too much about his early life, actually. But Ted Bundy is an interesting example. Ted Bundy is more nature than nurture. I've studied about 160 books about serial killers, and another 700 serial killers, about which is information from magazines and newspaper articles, but not such in-depth material. Ted Bundy is one of the few that was brought up by a decent, pleasant mother who married this fellow Ted Bundy when she escaped from her own very violent father, who may even have been the father of Ted Bundy. We don't know for sure whether he was an incest child. The debate back and forth. But the point is, Ted Bundy, his father, out in Seattle, never laid a hand on him and brought him up in modest but very nice circumstances. Even so, when he was a teenager, he became a peeping Tom, and he also killed somebody. Then when he aspired to have a girlfriend who was from a higher social class than he, and she rejected him, he then embarked on his career, if you will, of raping and killing one woman after the other, amounting to maybe some 30 or 35 women. So in his case, nurture played a very little role, and nature played a major role. He had a genetic predisposition to an aberrant personality characterized, you know, by the psychopathic features of superficial charm, callousness, lack of remorse, pathological lying, and then that led, you know, to him finally behaving the way that he did.
You mentioned his traits. I understand in your books you describe one of the other traits that is common in people like this is narcissism.
Yes. Self-centeredness. In other words, the inability to really feel depths of admiration for, compassion for, sympathy for, love, the true love, you know, for other human beings, including even to the point of having a partner or a spouse, you know, who inspires in you, you know, the wish to be with and also to do many things for the benefit of that other person. The narcissist is out for himself.
The book, The Anatomy of Evil, when you put this together, when you wrote this, who did you see as your prime target audience for this book?
Well, I wrote it hoping that people in the psychological professions would be interested in it, psychiatrists and psychologists who work in the forensic area. I began working in the forensic area myself, even though I started out in life as a psychoanalyst. At this point, I may be one of the very few psychoanalyst who actually have worked for many years in a forensic hospital, as I worked for about 18 years in a forensic hospital called Mid-Hudson, 60 miles away from New York City until recently. So, but I also hope that people in the forensic world, lawyers, judges, people in the prison, would be interested in what I had to say about these individuals as well.
It's also a fascinating topic for the layperson, in my opinion, as well. The book is called The Anatomy of Evil by Michael H. Stone, Dr. Michael H. Stone. Michael, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Thank you for having me. I enjoy it.
Dr. Michael H. Stone, author of The Anatomy of Evil. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0429, and you'll find links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Listen to this list of products and see if you can guess what they all have in common. Indoor extension cords, gasoline, wood matches, and fishing lures. Tough one, right? The answer is that versions of all these products carry a very scary-sounding warning label. It goes, "This product contains a chemical known to the state of California to cause cancer." That warning has been required on all kinds of products in California for more than 25 years, so a researcher there decided to see if cancer rates in that state are any lower than in places without that warning. His conclusion, reported in the Wall Street Journal, is that there isn't a single empirical study demonstrating any public health benefits. Let's be fair, the law must help someone, right? Well, the label on the fishing lure does warn, harmful if swallowed, so maybe some fish have benefited. But seriously, the law has created a lawsuit industry that has cost consumers plenty, and that's the real problem. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, coming to you from Montreal, Canada, where we share the longest unprotected border in the world with the United States. Take that as a sign of extreme friendship or a warning.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about the new app, Play the Future. Plus, we do indeed have an idiot of the day coming your way, but I got a few more Stuff File news stories that I want to share with you before we get to that. And I also want to mention, you know, earlier I talked about the fact that I was at a book signing in Kingston over the weekend. And again, thank you to Anthony D.P. Mann for setting that up in Kingston. Of course, the book I'm talking about is Great Conversations, My Interviews with Two Men in the Moon and a Galaxy of Stars. It is, of course, available. And like the title says, within the pages you'll find some of my celebrity encounters with Oscar winners like Carl Malden, Cloris Leachman, and Christopher Plummer, Emmy winners like Ed Asner, Michael Moriarty, and Lindsay Wagner, Tony winners like Carol Channing and Julie Newmar, and a host of TV icons such as Buddy Ebsen, Bob Denver, Dick Van Patten, Gary Coleman, and more. Plus, as the title suggests, two guys who actually set their footprints up on the moon. So check it out. It's available on Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, as well as the publisher's website at BearManorMedia.com. And of course, you'll find the links to the website for the book at my website, TheStuffFile.com. So buy the book. What are you waiting for? Just in time for the holidays, by the way. It makes a lovely Christmas gift. Anyway, back to the stuff. The Daily World in Centralia, Washington reported that 27-year-old Rachel A. Deckert tried to turn herself in at the Lewis County Jail on an outstanding DUI warrant back on August 21st, but was turned away because she brought along her partner, literally glued to Deckert by her pinky finger. Now, when Deckert tried again the next day, still attached to her partner, police and firefighters were called. The two women were attached by a copper elbow pipe into which they had each inserted a pinky finger secured with some kind of epoxy, a firefighter said. They told authorities that they had been that way for a week at the suggestion of a couple's therapy counselor. They haven't been able to feel their fingers for 3 days, said Police Detective Patty Finch. Efforts to separate the women were unsuccessful, and Deckert was released with advice to seek medical attention. Okay, right about now, I'm assuming that their couple's therapy counselor is sharing a laugh or two with other counselors, starting with the statement, "Let me tell you what I suggested one of my couples do, and they actually did."
Yeah.
Also, how do they go to the bathroom? Anyway, moving right along. When a central Wisconsin man got locked inside a convenience store cooler overnight, he made the best of it, knocking back a beer and three more malt beverages. Police were called to a quick trip in Marshfield. A customer had noticed the 38-year-old man inside the cooler around 6 a.m., and when employees opened it, he fled. When police found and arrested the man, he told them he went into the store to buy beer and got locked inside the cooler just before midnight. He told them he figured he might just as well stay inside and drink. Police cited the man for retail theft. They said the cooler had a glass door and he could have knocked on it to be let out. Well, when you're trapped for the long haul, it's always good to hydrate. Now that he's used to confinement, he'll be more acclimatized to being locked up, I'm sure. And in a similar vein, while we're talking about a story like that, authorities in Utah say a man who was hiding from police and fled arrest had to call 911 to be rescued after getting stuck in his hiding spot. Salt Lake City police say 46-year-old Shane Paul Owen called dispatchers for help more than 6 hours after he accidentally locked himself in a church boiler room. Officers were looking for Owens because he is a suspect in a string of burglaries and had warrants out for his arrest. Police say an officer spotted him and attempted to pull his vehicle over, but Owen fled, got out of his car, and ran into the church. A SWAT team held a standoff at the church until Owen called to be rescued. Wow. Stuck in a church boiler room. Oh, it can be hot as, well, you know, hell down there. Yeah, the Lord does work in mysterious ways. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? If you've ever contemplated how many liters of sauce Boston Pizza will use today, or what the total number of this week's six Powerball numbers will add up to, then there's an app for that. Those are just some of the questions posed by Play the Future, an app that combines predictive trivia with branded content. One of the brains behind the Montreal-based company is our good friend Andy Nullman of Just for Laughs fame. Andy joins us on the line right now from the nation's capital, Ottawa. Hi, Andy.
Hello, Peter, and thank you for that wonderful introduction.
Thanks for being on the program with us, and thanks for taking the time, because I know you're busy. As I said, you're not even here. You're away on business, as you always are. How did this Play the Future become a thing? What's the genesis for it?
It became a thing when myself and my partner, Parissa Foster, who worked with me at Airborne Mobile and at Just for Laughs, we saw that fantasy sports was huge and getting bigger in North America. And we said, well, why just sports? When you break it down, what is sports? It's basically a data point in the end, a score, amount of yardage gained, the amount of hits made, amount of goals scored. It's just a data point. And not everybody likes sports. We said, aren't there other data points that people will like? And obviously, we looked at weather, stock market, box office, entertainment, the awards season, and brands. People love brands and shop, and they have different sales figures and on-time figures, and you name it. So we said, but let's put together a fantasy life app for the rest of the world who doesn't like sports. Let's go after the people who fantasy sports market are not getting, primarily, let's say, millennials and females. And that's who we got.
Now, as I mentioned in the introduction, it's also branded content. So I guess that's the opportunity to mix business with trivia. How does it work from a corporate point of view?
Well, we call it future trivia because of Siri, Alexa, and Google. Trivia is dead. Any trivia question you ask can be answered within a second or a microsecond just by saying, Siri, how many X's are in Y? If the answer is no, it can be looked up. But if you're talking about making predictions about tomorrow, no matter what, it cannot be looked up because it hasn't happened yet. So when we talk to brands, we say that your data points are equally as interesting as anything, and they tell stories about your brand. And the more when people play your brand, they get engaged in it, they actually care more. So all this means that when next time they go shopping, if they've played your brand, they've engaged with you, and you will shine like a beacon when they pass you, when they pass your stuff in the grocery aisle or at the pharmacy or wherever. So it really boils down to, you know, some very, very basic neuroscience. But you know, when you strip it away, I'll give you an example. Dannon is one of our brands, and one of the questions we asked for Dannon was how many M&Ms will be used in this week's production of Yo Crunch. Yo Crunch is their product that mixes yogurt and crunchy stuff. And you know, we gave them a mathematical hint. There's X amount of average amount of M&Ms in each cup, average amount of cups produced in an average run. So people have a parameter, you know, of a guess they can make. And in the end, they make a guess, and they find out, you know, a couple of days later that the answer was, you know, 8,342,212. People say, wow, that's a hell of a lot of M&Ms. And suddenly they've learned this story, and their mind is filled with, you know, tons of M&Ms and yogurt, and that's what this really is. So it paints these pictures in people's heads and gets people engaged in something as mundane as a production line.
Now, when it comes to trivia, people are, or any kind of game, people are competitive. One of the things on the site is, of course, a leaderboard, so you can compete with others to see how you stack up to them. Besides that, though, there are prizes. So tell us about the prizes and how those are factored in.
Well, we have different categories, you know, weather, commerce, odds and ends, sports, showbiz, I can go on, and the branded categories, of course. So what happens is that each week, there's a prize for each category. So yes, there are leaderboards, but you may be terrible at showbiz, but really good at weather. You may be horrible at commerce, but great at Oikos yogurt or Via Rail. So what happens is you know, the prizes you get are analogous to the category. So if you're talking yogurt, you know, each week, you know, the top five players get free, you know, coupons that give them a free week of yogurt. Via Rail in the past has given away, you know, $75 travel vouchers to the top two players you know, per week. So, you know, it depends. You know, so what this does is allow brands to not just get into people's heads, but actually sample people as well. You know, let them try the product. And in addition, you know, one of the great thrills is when you get your result, because you get, you know, when you have. You make a prediction without getting the results, like a tree falling in the forest, it doesn't make a sound. The goal is to see how you did. But when you get the result, which is a push to your phone, you see, I mean, we have this barometer that shows you how well you've done, and if you've done well, it shouts out at you, and it's very Vegas-y. But I'll tell you, you do well, there's a release of dopamine. You feel good when you get that. And then you see how you do stacking up against the rest of the world who are playing it. So, you know, even if you don't win a prize, it's still what we call a feel-good factory because of the neuroscience and the dopamine release.
Now, if I'm not mistaken, you first released this, set it up in January of last year. Is that correct?
Yeah, we went in Canada only for a year. Now we're worldwide. But what's happening now is that the people we're really talking to are showing interest in this are two main verticals: the gaming industry, lottery companies, gambling companies around the world, who are saying, yeah, this is a way to reach a female and a younger audience, and to get into their lives, to play the news, to play what's on their minds and what's on their tongues every day, what they're talking about, what they're sharing on Facebook and on Twitter. It becomes, you know, a competitive sport. You know, the news gathering and news sharing becomes a competitive sport. So that's the gaming lottery element. And the media side, what we're doing is we're working with different media companies about playing the news and playing guests on their shows. So in other words, I you know, we're just about finalizing a deal with a national talk show where we will be playing, you know, the news, having to deal with the people who come on their show. So you basically play the guest. So guest appears on the show. You say, okay, here's this guest. They're playing a concert on Friday. How many people will be at their concert on Friday?
It's for those who aren't familiar with how this game is played and haven't had a chance to go to the site and see it, and by the way, it's playthefuture.com. It's very similar to anybody who's a football fan who knows that long myriad of opportunities to guess and to vote on things that will take place through the course of the Super Bowl.
That's right. But we've just taken that and put that into everyday life. So, Peter, you know, when we raise money for this, we would go to, we would play the meetings. We would play the meetings and we would say, okay, we are pitching you. How long is this pitch going to be? Yes, it lasts 30 minutes in the calendar, but will it go actually 30 minutes or will it go 32:10, 28:50? Will you be bored and kick us out of here in 15 minutes? How many slides is my deck going to have? How many times is my phone going to ring and interrupt us? So that we would make the, and then we would show them how engaged they were in the presentation because of this, and that basically helped sell it. So when I say we have two credos that play the future. If it can be measured, it can be played, and life's a game. And even this interview can be played, you know, Peter. We can say, I know you said it's 10 minutes, but is it really going to be 10 minutes? Maybe 10:02, 9:58, whatever. You know, we can guess, you know, how many times Andy's going to swear during the interview. I guess the answer to that would be zero, because I don't want you to be, you know, embarrassed and humiliated with my dirty mouth. And, you know, how many questions will you ask? How many times, you know, will I not shut up and not allow you to ask another question? So basically, you know, anything could be played, including this here interview.
We're at the 8:53 mark right now. I'll tell you that as we go along. and also, what is the day-to-day like? How is there a room where a lot of people sit around and say, okay, these are the questions, these are the queries that we're going to come up with today, tomorrow, whatever the case may be?
We have a content team that operates like a newsroom. They come in the morning. They check what's trending on Twitter, what's trending on, what people are talking about trending on Facebook, what's trending on Google. They'll check the news sites. And they, at one point in time, they say, this is what the world is talking about. And that's how they formulate the questions for the next day. But then again, we're flexible enough that if something wild happens, we're able to jump right on it. So, for example, you know, I remember when Donald Trump held his first press conference, we call these the lightning rounds. It's almost like breaking news. We said, okay, Trump is holding his press conference in a half hour. How many times will he mention the word Russia in his press conference? And people had, you know, 15 minutes to put in a prediction. And then, you know, an hour later, we had the result. So, you know, even no matter what happens, we can jump on it and send out a prediction that people have to make and give them the answer almost immediately.
By the way,
it really does operate like a newsroom.
By the way, you could do one every day. With how late will Sarah Huckabee Sanders be to start her press conference?
Oh my God, there's so much we can. The White House alone, we can do a standalone app on the White House, and it's ironic because we played Donald Trump like a brand leading up to the election. You know, when it was funny, when he won, it stopped, you know, getting funny at that point in time. It wasn't funny anymore. But we led up to it, and we played Donald Trump every month. We had 10 questions a month on Donald Trump, and we were giving away prizes like Donald Trump masks, Donald Trump toilet paper, Donald Trump Make America Great Again hats. You know, we just played him like a brand. It was, you know, go figure, he's going to become the president. I'll give you a funny story, Peter. When we played the American election, we had all sorts of questions about the election. What color tie is he going to wear during his speech? What color outfit will Hillary wear during her speech? We had questions about states, margins of victory, all sorts of stuff. But the one question we didn't ask was, who's going to win? Because we were so sure, based on all the polls, that Hillary is going to win. And we said, well, that question is going to go ahead and, you know, it's an obvious win for whoever's playing this, so we're not even going to ask it. Go figure.
What kind of numbers are we talking about, or do you give those out as the amount of people who are actively playing?
Well, in September, we had 120,000 monthly active users. But what's really important is, and what we use this when we sell this, is the engagement level. The people who, you know, it's like the old Alexander Keith slogan, those who like it a lot. We're not going, you know, although, again, this is a game for the masses, but what we really want to make sure is that people, it's the engagement that we're going after. That people come back to this and play this three times a day, for about a minute every time. They continue to play for about 2-3 months, which in the world of gaming, mobile gaming, is pretty huge. So that's what we're seeing right now, and that's really what we're selling, is the fact that people come here and they engage with your brand, and we give every person we partner with the opportunity to, when the results come, to have a link out to an offer, to a coupon, to a video that explains something, to something promotional, as an added bonus for the person who plays.
It's a lot of fun. It's kind of addictive. The game is called Play the Future. People can find out more information by going to playthefuture.com. Andy, I thank you very much for being on the program with us for now over 12 minutes and 40 seconds.
You see what I mean? So go as whoever would pick that time. I congratulate you, and you win a Peter Anthony Holder Stuff File T-shirt.
Offer void where prohibited. That was Andy Nauman, one of the guys behind Play the Future. You can find out more information by going to their website, playthefuture.com, and you can go to my website at thestufffile.com. Check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0429, and you'll find the link. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
58-year-old Michael Keene of Silverdale, Washington, was in jail on vehicular homicide charges when he had a sudden realization. He called his son and another man from the jail's phone and allegedly asked them to retrieve guns from his car's trunk. "You guys got nothing to worry about," Keene allegedly said to his son, "but I do. Just say it's yours and it's no big deal because it's not registered. That's all." Now, since jailhouse phones are monitored, a fact inmates are informed of each and every time they use the phones, police were notified and searched Keene's trunk before anyone else could get there, and they found an AR-15 and AK-47 magazines and ammunition. Keene is a convicted felon and therefore prohibited from possessing firearms, so another criminal charge was added to his file: unlawful possession of firearms. He's going to need to make another phone call, it would appear. But seriously, why? Oh, why would someone who clearly has been a guest of the state on several occasions and should be fully versed on the use of phones in jail make such a boneheaded call about guns in his car just after he had been warned his call would be monitored? One reason, and one reason only: he's an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0429. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0429. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder, and don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes, streaming on Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
Been getting jiggy with Peter Anthony Holder and the Stuff File program, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. He's a bad mamma jamma, and after he spends some chill time in his crib, he'll be back to get down with his bad self. Word up.